Now, officially, I guess I was supposed to give this Musar Vayin, but unofficially, I'm not supposed to give it because Rabbi Kier was very considerate, and he went ahead and asked Rabbi Dreyfus to give it because he's being that I am officially sick, which I'm still playing sick, and therefore, unofficially, it's past my bedtime for being sick, so I was not supposed to give this Musar Vayin. However, I thought of my Dreyfus this morning that I want to give the vad, because tonight happens to be my mother's yard site. So what if it's my mother's yard site? Is because there is a concept, which is a very important concept. We discussed this many, many times. There's a thing called mitzvahs hanegraos. Mitzvahs hanegraos means that when you do one mitzvah, very often you can get another mitzvah. And that mitzvah brings another mitzvah. It's a chain that never stops. One of the mitzvahs in the Grais is kibbutz av v'aim. Means every time you do a mitzvah, you give a zchus to your parents. Because your parents get a zchus that they were geirim. They created you. They taught you. They educated you. And therefore, because of them, you are doing your mitzvahs. Even if they didn't educate you, they gave birth to you. But especially if they educated you. So your mitzvah is a direct totzah of their being. The Chazal say, bra mezaka abba. A child is mezaka a parent. So anytime a child does a mitzvah, the parents get a zchus. Now, okay, that's a good thing, Stam, if you like your parents. You want to give your parents chusim. But it's also even for yourselves. Because we believe that a zchus is the most valuable thing in the world. So if you're giving madach, if your parents ask you for a cup of water, and you give them a cup of water, you're getting a mitzvah kibbutz av v'aim. So if you give them a zchus is worth much more than a cup of water, right? So and for sure you're kaim a mitzvah a kibbutz av v'aim. So one of the mitzvahs on the grace is every time you do any mitzvah. Right now I'm doing a mitzvah of teaching Torah. So I'm teaching Torah, I'm giving my mother a zchus. Also giving my father a zchus. That's two mitzvahs, by the way, just for the record. Also giving my grandfather a zchus. I think this kibbutz av v'aim for grandparents too. And I have four grandparents, right? So there's and each one is a mitzvah. It keeps on going. A lot of mitzvahs.
Do you have kavana?
I don't know if you have to have kavana, but I keep on saying have sometimes general awareness. You don't have to have kavana every second. Is that okay? Anyway, so the ma'isa, that's now, it's brought in this farm, that's any time, whether your parents are alive or dead, you know, Hashem, they're alive. But it seems that the mitzvah goes up greater after the parents die. I can't explain why, but the parents are alive, since they can go ahead and do mitzvahs for themselves, so they're not considered as needy. So it's not like you're doing them as great as much as a zchus, as a chesed. But when they can't do mitzvahs themselves, so they're considered more needy. So even though it says clearly in the Svarim that it's a mitzvah, even your parents are alive to do a mitzvah, but it's a greater mitzvah when they're dead. There's a sefer in the Hakdama to the Lei Vedio. He brings a gevaldik story that the Rav Leo, Rav Leo Lapian, was, you know, he was a young teenager during the years of the Russian Revolution. Those who know your Jewish history or world history, the Russian Revolution, there was mamish a famine because Lenin, who was a tremendous Russia, went ahead and he intentionally created an artificial famine in Russia in order so that the people should give up their farms. And a few million people starved to death. He starved to death a few million Russian citizens on purpose, so that they should be ready to give up their farms. And, you know, he basically burnt all the food and all the seed so they couldn't plant unless they would come and ask for seed from the government. And in the process, a few million people died. So people were literally starving to death. And the only way basically to survive, or the easiest way to survive, is young boys who are energetic could go ahead and find food. So the Viola Apian's mother was an almana, I believe. So her husband, she didn't have a husband to help her get food. She was by herself. Maybe she had some daughters. And she had, I think, two sons, and they were both in yeshivas. So some of her neighbors said, "You're crazy. You're starving. It's so hard. You got two sons. That's a gold mine, you know. Call them back from yeshiva and put them to work looking for food." So she said, I'm saving my sons to give me food when I can't feed myself. Right? Meaning that La'achar me'ev esrim, I'll get plenty of packages from my son, which I'm sure she did, because Rabbi Yonah Pian sent her a lot of care packages. Right? So that's the hashgafa. Hashgafa is that when anytime you do a mitzvah, especially after the person's nifter, it's a schus for the nifter. And it's especially true on a yard site. Now, I am not qualified to explain to you why a yard site is different, but there is going to, it's clear and everywhere that the neshama somehow has an aliyah more on the yard site, more than any other time. There's an inyan, we go to the kever on a yard site. The minig is we go to, you know, if Be'ezus Hashem, assuming we are, you know, we're in the Eretz Yisrael during certain yard sites, there's a minig, there's the, we should be there for the Or HaChaim's yard site. If it's in Yerushalayim, hopefully we'll go to the Or HaChaim's kever. If we're there at the end of Elo, of you said it was Vav El, you said? Is the Arizal's yard site? Hey, Vav. He messed it up again. Hey, Av is the Arizal's yard site in Sfas. We'll see if we can go there. It's an Indian to go to a cavern yard site because there's such a thing. One God, they'll tell me that there's a Yishalmi that says Halacha Kemoiso on the yard site. Somehow the mace has special kaiches. I don't know, whatever it is. I can't explain. I do not understand why a yard site is different. I'm sure somebody who's a Mekabawa can explain it, but I do not know. But it is such a concept that a yard site, that's why we daven for the Amid, we try to do extra mitzvahs. So Memeida, since tonight is my yard site, so I didn't want to turn down an opportunity to say a Musar Vad. So even though maybe I'm sure my driver would have done a better job, but that wouldn't help my mother. So, okay, anyway, so that's why I'm saying a Musar Vad. So what's my trying to say? That I have an excuse. If it's no good, it's because I'm sick. But okay, no. It's an important hashkafa to know that anytime you do a mitzvah, you should, I don't say you have to have an active kavana, but you should have an awareness that you're besides a mitzvah, the mitzvah, you're getting a mitzvah sanigrais of doing chesed to your parents and kibud av v'aim. Okay. Anyway, so I wanted to talk about a few different things, but I wanted to talk about focus on first of all, on a few different topics related to my mother. There's one topic I always talk about, and I apologize if you heard it already, but to me it's very meaningful, and something that's very meaningful, even if you heard it already, it pays to hear again. Right. Rav Avraham Trupp, that's the Rebbetzin father, told me, I heard it, he said, we say on the Haggadah, that he was a Granat's oldest son. He was a very big Gadah. He lived in the Rosh Yeshiva's house. So he says, we say in the Haggadah of Pesach, Afilu kulanu achamim kivanim, how does it go? Someone help me. Kivanim nivonim. Kivanim yaydeh etzara. Okay, somewhere, someone else there. Okay. Anyway, so it says, so we ask the Kasha, why should that be? If we know it already, so what's the inyan of saying it? So he said, to an old man who had some amazing thing happen to him. And he tells his grandson, he says, "Son, did I ever tell you about my war episode during the Civil War? Did I ever tell you that story?" "Zayda, you told me that 25 times. "Well, I'm going to tell it to you again." He said that when you, in something very meaningful happened to you, you never tire of saying that weird story. Rav Trapp said. So he said that since there's an inyan, Chayiv Adam Liras Etzasma Kidehu Yatsam Yitzrayim, of course, the Rambam is a different gerza, but that's the simple gerza, that a person is supposed to feel that he went out of Mitzrayim. So if we actually went out of Mitzrayim, we would never tire saying it over, even if we said it already, and even if everyone knows it, and even if the audience know it. But you don't tire saying it over. You enjoy saying it over, right? All the people say, I'm going off on a tangent, that can I trouble someone to turn on the air condition? Does someone have a key? Anyone have a key? No, I got a key somewhere, I think. You want to see if you can find a key? One of these keys might work. It's a little hot. Well, if you can figure out how to get it out of there, too. I don't know. Anyway, thank you. So many Gedonim say that we do it to say there. Most people tell Vortlachs on the Haggadah. But the Iker Mitzvah is not to say Vortlach. The Iker Mitzvah is to say over the Tzias Mitzrayim. Because that's the Sapri Tzias Mitzrayim. Okay, anyway, so even though I said this already, I'm saying it again. It's too bad on you people. Captive audience. So first of all, I think I'll say some new things. First of all, my mother had an interesting life, like most people of her generation. Life was not so simple. She was born basically in America. Her parents married in America. So she was, her father was a very frum Jew. I guess she was born in 1924, I believe. And her father owned a apple farm upstate New York. I don't know exactly at what age he owned it, but that's where she grew up. He grew up he was in America. He came to America like 20 years earlier. He worked and he saved up his money and he eventually bought an apple farm. And my mother lived there until the Great Depression, at which point he could not meet his mortgage payments. He was foreclosed. He lost every penny he owned and he had to give up his apple farm. Doesn't sound too good. My mother loved the farm. She loved country. But in retrospect, it probably, from retrospect now, it probably was the best thing for her, because in upstate New York, I don't know exactly how likely it is to remain from. And after he lost the farm, they moved back to New York, to Borough Park. So the family, the truth is my mother's oldest sister became conservative because she grew up more on the farm, and all the rest of the family remained very orthodox. So I think that was a blessing in disguise. But okay. Anyway, basically, skipping to the end, my parents always wanted to move to Eretz Yisrael. They always wanted to move before they got married. My parents had friends that got killed in the War of 48. They went to Eretz Yisrael. My mother was, she was working on a farm in 40-something to prepare for moving to Eretz Yisrael, because in those days, everyone thought you're going to have to work on a farm in Eretz Yisrael. So she actually volunteered on a farm, so she knew how to work on a farm. So my parents' dream was always to live to Eretz Yisrael. Her three children got in the way, and they finally decided that they were going to wait to move to Eretz Yisrael after their three children got married. And of course, the youngest child, who was me, was very uncooperative, and he got married very late. So they could not move to Eretz Yisrael until I got married, which was a little late. So as soon as I got married, they decided their plans. Okay, they're moving to Eretz Yisrael. They moved to Eretz Yisrael. They sold their house in Forest Hills. They moved to Eretz Yisrael. And basically, a month later, they're back in America. What happened? They found a growth. It was diagnosed as cancer. They needed an operation. They told her to come back to America, which was very difficult because they had nowhere to stay in America. So they had to move into my little teeny Kodo apartment, which did not really, if you know what Kodo apartments are like with families and kids, wasn't so comfortable. And this went on for like 6 years. She had one operation, another operation, a third operation, and basically she never got better. And the cancer got worse. And I don't remember, it was 6 or 7 years later, she was nifter. So first of all, my mother always was very happy. She used to always say that she's one of the luckiest people in the world. She had good husband, a good kids, whatever, which itself is a lesson. You know, she died at, I think, 64, which is relatively young. But, you know, some people can get very bitter. But what I want to stress, I know I said this before, that at the Levaya was at Chofetz Chaim Yeshiva in Sanhedrin Rechavet. My father and my mother had a very, very close marriage, Baruch Hashem. And my father said at the Levaya that this last year of their life together was the happiest year of their life. He said that at the Levaya. And I'm sitting there, I was in total shock. Because I used to, call my mother every day. And I knew the last year of my mother's life, she was so sick. The cancer was, I don't know if you know how cancer works, but the body deteriorates. Basically, her body was deteriorating. She couldn't barely function. She could barely walk. She could barely stand. For the last year, the doctors already had given up hope. She knew already she was dying. There was nothing to hope for. The doctor said it's hopeless. She was sick. I knew she was nauseous. She had terrible nauseous, much worse than I feel nauseous from my men. She was nauseous, much, 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 much worse. And, so how can my father say it was the happiest year of his life? So I asked him, I'm going to say that sitting down. I said, how can you say such a thing? So he said, shot, push it. He said, every year they kept on saying, we're busy now, we're putting off enjoying life till later, right? We're going to move, our dream is to move to Eretz Yisrael. We can't move to Eretz Yisrael now, we'll move next year. Our dream is to do this and this. We can't do it now because we're busy, we'll do it next year. He said, basically the doctors told them that there's no next year, that's it. So they made a conscious decision to have to be happy now, because I'm lo ashav emasai. And he said that they made an effort every day to be happy. And he says it was the happiest year of their life. Notwithstanding the fact that most of the day my mother was nauseous and she couldn't function. But he said it was like an hour of the day. I remember it was like an hour of the day from like 2 to 3, I don't remember exactly, that for some reason the nauseousness went away and she could function. An hour, 2 hours maybe, a window in the day. So he said they made an effort every day to be happy, and it was the happiest day of their life, year of their life. So I think there's a tremendous Musar Haskel, I think. Right? Seeing people have problems, and we complain, and we get grumpy. If you want to be happy, you can be dying of cancer, and you can be happy. You can be dying of cancer, you can be nauseous, you can be sick, you can be in pain, and you can be the happiest years of your life. Right? It's a tremendous lesson. Okay, that's one lesson. Okay, another lesson, also in happiness, which is a little bit of an etzah, how to be happy. My parents were very close to Rav Goldvich. I don't know if you people know who Rav Goldvich was. Rav Goldvich was the Reshiva of Karen Biavne. He was a pretty chashev gadol. He was a Talmud of the Chazon Ish, and he started and founded, he was a founding Rosh Hashiva of Karen Biavne. Okay. He's a very fascinating person, because how does a Talmud of the Chazon Ish get to Rosh Hashiva of Karen Biavne? It's a long story, but that's not for now. But he was a chashev, very chashev Talmud of the Chazon Ish, who was somehow the Rosh Hashiva of Karen Biavne. He was a very charismatic person, powerful, big, whatever. His number is Svarim. And at the end of it, he came a Shabbos. My father was a shul rabbi in Israel Forest Hills, so he came for Shabbos to raise money for yeshiva. And they met then. And then later, they stayed in touch. And then eventually, as Hashkacha work out, Rav Goldvich retired. I don't know if retired is the right word, because I think he really got booted out of Karen Biavne. But when he left Karen Biavne, he moved to my parents lived in Arzi Abira, so they became very close again, more so. They were neighbors. But he was a very chashvei gadol. So he came to Menachem Avil, and he told this following thing. I think I just told it to someone recently. Maybe I said it to a whole Shir, a Musar group. So again, I apologize. He said, we were sitting Shiva. My father was obviously very distraught. I don't know what the exactly right word is. So he told the following story. He said there was a person who was very, very makbid that any time he had a rich person, that when the butler brought him anything, a glass of water, at any time he had to bring it, there was a whole, I don't know what they say in English. You know, a whole system had to have on a silver tray, and had to be in a special cup with a napkin. You know, there was you could just bring a cup of water. There was a whole
procedure.
Okay. So his wife was nifter, this rich person, and it's such a hard day, and they go to the Basic Forest, and it's a hot day in the Basic Forest, and he comes back from the Basic Forest, and he's hot, and he's depressed. And he tells the butler, I need a drink. So the butler comes, and Stam gives them a cup of water. Stam, a cup of water, without all the silver tray and the special cup and the napkin and, you know, all the extras, so to speak. So the Baal Bas gets upset. What's going on here? This is how you give me a cup of water. What's wrong with you? So the butler gets, a little bit, when you scream at someone, so the human nature is always they scream back. He says, I just figured a day like this, you're going to be mocked at an Irish guide. So the Baal Bas said, Adiraba. He says, I just got a clap. I got a very big clap. What you have to do when you get a clap is make sure you don't get two claps. Meaning, human nature is, when they have a problem, they let the problem grow, right? You make the problem gets bigger, right? The typical example, which is not exactly the same, but it's very similar. Your two kids come home from school, and there's one cupcake, and the mother cuts it in half. And of course, one cupcake is slightly bigger than the other. Really, it's not, but that's what they imagine. One cupcake is bigger. So they both want the bigger one. And what does the mother have to do? So she has to decide, and she gives one of them the bigger one. So what does the other kid do? He takes his smaller one, which is very 50% chance it's not even smaller, but it's irrelevant, and he takes it and he throws it away. I don't want it. Right? So that's human nature. When you have a problem, I got the smaller one. So then, everything is right. I got ahead. I didn't do well in a test. Okay, I'm dropping out of the course. I didn't get the chavrusa I wanted. So I'm not going to learn. Right? If things don't go perfect, so even though you're right, it's a problem. You got a good taina. Things didn't work out the way you wanted it to. You got a clap. But what many people do is they take that clap and they turn it into two claps, because because they're upset with the first clap, they make it a second clap. So he says, I got a clap. I got a clap, I lost my wife. Now, if I'm going to lose my dignity, that's another clap. Now, it's much trivial, but it's worth a clap. I won't have to go ahead and isolate the clap. So Rav Goldman said this to my father. He was saying when he came to me. I heard it too. He was saying it to, I don't know if he was saying it to me, but he was saying it to my father in sitting Shiva. You got to clap. What you have to do when you get a big clap is don't allow the clap to spread to another clap. You got to isolate it exactly to where it is. It's interesting. My father really himself said almost the same thing. When we came home from the Fura. So in Israel, apartments also are not very big. My parents had really a one-bedroom apartment, one-and-a-half-bedroom, because my father had a little study, which could theoretically be another bedroom, but it was like a small room. So it was a pretty teeny apartment. So now, where are you going to sit Shiva? You know, and especially in Israel, the men and the women, you have to sit separately. So somebody, you know, I won't mention who, some relative of mine, as a chesed, before while we were at the base like Varis, they went ahead and they reorganized all the furniture in the living room, dining room. It was like one living room, dining room. It wasn't a very big room, but it was a living room, dining room, room, you know. So they organized, figured out the furniture so that there should be room for the men to sit and the women to sit. So my father came home, and he got so angry. And I've never seen him get so angry. You put everything back the way it was. And he said, he was a shul rabbi for years. And he says, and this always happened. People get a avaya. Some person who thinks he's doing a chesed comes ahead and messes up the whole house. Then, of course, after Shiva, they all disappear. And the Ovel is left with a house in total disarray. He doesn't know where anything is. Right? That's a nacha clap. If you have the house, at least the house is the same. The house is the same. The table is the same place. The couch is the same place. There's a certain soothing. It's obviously, it's trivial, but it's still, it takes away the pain. But what happens? You mess up the house during Shiva because you're trying to help them. And then everyone goes away. And meanwhile, you gave the oven another clap. So he was very mad. The first thing we did, we came home from the funeral, from the kfura, is everything had to be put exactly where it was, in the exact same spot. And then we sat down, there's a Suda's Havra, whatever you did. That was the first thing he did. Because it's the same hashkafa. You have to be careful, even though some things seem trivial, but they're not trivial. Everything is an added thing. You got a clap. Just because it's a big clap, you don't exaggerate it. Don't make it any bigger, right? Don't make it worse. Don't get, you know, you get a clap and then you get depressed over it. You get depressed, it becomes a bigger clap. Okay. Anyway, so that's a second lesson. The first lesson is that if a person wants to be happy, you can be happy almost in any situation. And a second lesson is a coping skill, that if something really goes haywire and wrong, you have to isolate it. And even little things, you got to make sure you don't. You know, and let's say a person has a terrible tragedy. You don't resign your position. You don't say, no, I can't be the president anymore. I just don't have my heart in being the president. Right? You're the shul president. And then you have a terrible tragedy. You know, lo aleinu, someone was nifter, a child, a wife. And I can't be the president anymore. I'm too depressed. No. You got to keep on being the president. That would be another clap. You got to keep on doing everything the same you used to do. Right? It's a very important rule in life. In coping with problems. Okay.
Isn't there a step that maybe that's not always coping with problems? Sometimes something heavily ignoring the problems.
I'm ignoring the problem. I assure you, my father was not in denial. He knew very much that my mother was nifter. But he's isolating it. Okay. I was going to tell this story for Shmuel, but okay, he's not here, but we'll tell it to him anyway. The question is marriage. So my parents happened to have a very good marriage. So this story, my father used to always say, he obviously did not say it at the Levaya because he didn't know it at the Levaya. But it's a story which shows what a marriage is supposed to be, which, you know, why maybe you guys are too young to get married. Because people think marriage is about getting, and really marriage is about giving. So basically, my father said that every family, it's not a marriage, and family have certain routines, right? There's routines. Well, that's the way, I'm sure every house is, you know, certain things, you have a routine. Erev Sukkot, you build this, you know, whatever it is. You do. So my father had a routine that my father was a Rav. He used to be the Baal Makri for Rosh Hashanah. I think even in Israel he was a Makri Rosh Hashanah. I'm not sure if that's true at this point, but he was later. I don't know if at this point he was. So he needed his kittel for Rosh Hashanah. If not for Rosh Hashanah, he needed it for Yom Kippur. So the minig every year for his entire marriage life, is that Erev Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, depending on when it was needed, my mother would take the kittah out of the closet. It's all dusty and wrinkled. It's been lying in the closet for a whole year and, you know, stuffed in who knows what. And she would wash it and iron it. And he would have a kittah ready for Rosh Hashanah. Okay? So my mother was nifter. Today is a chavdalid adar. That's 6 months before Rosh Hashanah. So obviously, you know, no one thinking about the kittah. So comes Rosh Hashanah, and all of a sudden, Rosh Hashanah, and my father realizes he needs a kittah, and of course, it's, every time something reminds him, this year I'm not going to have a kittah ready. You know, I'm going to have to wear a wrinkled kittah. Okay, what can you do? He goes to the closet, and he finds a hanger with a big suit bag on it with a paper stuck on it, kittah. He opens it up, and of course, there was a kittah already ironed, which means that at least 6 months before she was nifter, my mother realized that she wasn't going to make it till Rosh Hashanah, so she ironed his kittah in advance. The chiddush was that my father said he didn't know how she could do it because she couldn't move an ironing board. She was too weak to iron. So she needed help time. So he doesn't know how he did it. Maybe she could ask someone to come in and help her. I don't know. But anyway, that's what is in a marriage. Marriage is not about, about getting. You have to be considerate of other people. Oh, I was going to tell another story. Nothing about marriage, but about being smart. I guess it's also a good story. I'm telling stories. I hope no one minds. My mother used to always tell this story about her mother. When they were on the farm, she said they had this apple farm. So this was in the early 30s, 20s. So they had they sold the apples on a road on a stand next to the road. They filled up the stand with their apples, and people would drive by, and they would buy the apples. So obviously at night, there was too heavy to move all the apples. So they would just cover up the stand. They would have cloth, and they would cover it up. So one day, her husband, my grandfather, went away. So it says my grandmother was home alone on the farm with, she had four daughters. I don't think they had a telephone or anything, right? Four daughters. About 3 o'clock in the morning, they hear a car stop in front of their stand, and they hear the guy taking off canvas, whatever it is, and basically taking the apples, right? The guy's gonna clean them out. No one's coming, right? 3 o'clock in the morning, obviously. Now, what do you do? So, the grandma doesn't want them to know that her husband's not home. It's even worse. So my mother says, your grandmother sticks her head out the window and says, "Don't worry, it's okay, you can take, I trust you, just put the money in the can next there, it's all right, don't worry." So the guy, believe it or not, he put the money in the can and he drove off, right? So what's that a lesson in? That when you tell someone that you trust them, they can't, they can't steal from you, The guy was in the middle of stealing, but the guy said, "Oh, I trust you. You're an honest person. I can tell that you're honest." Just, like a hole in my head, So she said the guy actually put out some money and he drove away. Okay, anyway. Okay, I wanted to talk about something else. I see I'm running out of time. There's a concept. This has nothing to do with anything, but a different topic. There's a concept that I think we gave a schmooze about last year, that there's such a thing. There's a famous story that the Chassam Sofer had a Baal Bus, who was a rich Baal Bus, who the Chassam Sofer saw that on Yom Kippur, the minig in the Chassam Sofer's city was that the Talmidei Chachamim used to stay up all Yom Kippur and learn Torah in shul. They would sit in shul. Maybe they would have fallen asleep in the shul, but they basically stayed up all night. They would maybe sleep a little bit in the shul and sit up and learn. So the Baal Chassam Sofer noticed one of the Ashirim of the community, who didn't give as much stock as he was supposed to, setting up a place for himself to sit in the shul and learn all night. So the Chassam Sofer went over to him and says, in an army, if every person in an army has a job, let's say you're the cook, you have a job, and you're given a job to deliver food to some soldiers. You're driving the food wagon, and you pass the ammunition wagon turned over, and the ammunition is carried all over, and the soldiers desperately need ammunition. You need ammunition more than you need food. He says, if he's going to stop and pick up the ammunition, he's going to be late in delivering the food, they're going to court-martial him. Because your job in the army is to follow your orders. It's for the general to figure out what the orders should be. But you got to follow your orders. So he says, the orders, Hashem gives different orders to different people. Rich people's orders is to sleep in comfortable beds and give tzedakah. Talmid Achamim's orders is to sleep in the shul and learn. You, out of here. Right? Because you're not doing your job. Right? Anyway, a person has to know what his job is. Sometimes, even if the other job looks more important, right? Simple example. Let's say Rabbi Nyman hears about one of our branches that's having a terrible financial time. Right? And now he meets a nice Baal Bus who has the potential of giving a nice donation. Rabbi Nyman is not supposed to ask him, well, maybe you can give Manalapam a nice donation, right? You know, even he's not supposed to do that because his job is to worry about Miami. Doesn't mean Manalapam doesn't need the money more, but that's not your job. Maybe Rabbi Grunblatt, who's the head of all the institutions, maybe he has that achrayas, because he's also in theoretically in charge of all the institutions. But Rabbi Nyman has nothing to Manalapam. That therefore he has no. It's not. It would be the teachers and here would have a right to be fuming in Rabbi Nyman. It'll be an avla. Your job is to take care of Miami. You got to take care of Miami. Okay. Anyway, so the shaila is. I think I said this last year too, that there's a certain thing that it goes to the you guys also, that by learning here, it comes with a certain amount of achrayas. There's a piece in the Torah Avram that he says that it's a fascinating piece. No one holds his weight, halacha, but that doesn't mean it's not right, just no one does it. That there's a din of a chesed sheyesh radei acherim is a mitzvah. Sheyesh radei acherim is doich etam etayra. Right? That's the din. So the Torah Avram says, but if you're learning in yeshiva, it's not true, because you're a worker for the yeshiva. Because when you come to a yeshiva, it's like you signed the contract. The yeshiva will supply you with the ability to learn, but you're going to learn b'hasmada, because the yeshiva needs your learning b'hasmada to help the yeshiva to succeed. So if you're a worker, there's no heter just because if a guy's a worker and you got to do your job. It's too bad. There's mincha. You can't die with a minion. You got to do your job. So he says there's no heter, for sure chesed, but even many other mitzvahs too. Okay, we don't do that. Yeshiva's Michael. But the Maisa, the guys do, I really do think, the guys have a certain amount of an achrayas to help the yeshiva. Now, I know the guys are great and they went collecting, but the biggest help of the yeshiva, help collecting is very nice. And how much did the guys raise? You know? What? Not enough. But whatever they raise is very nice. But the Maisa, that's really not going to make it or break it. Because yeshiva has like a $10 billion budget, so, okay. You know, but it's nice. Definitely makes a difference. But what really will make or break the yeshiva is if we have Talmidim here.